The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Today we'll begin looking back at Monday's Premier League action. Chelsea ride their luck at Brighton in a game of who's the best right back. Wolves beat Sheffield United in 6 minutes. Is that how long all games should be these days? After that, we'll take a deep dive into the EFL, some wild predictions, some hot takes, and hopefully some more Wes Houlihan chat. Sid Lowe will talk the return of La Liga and insects. We'll ask if it's a problem if teams keep putting nine past their opponents in the WSL. And since yesterday, we've been invited out to dinner with Damien Delaney. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Barry Glendenning, nice to see you as always.
A pleasure, Max. How are you?
It's like you won't go away.
I do apologise.
That's okay.
I'm like a bad smell.
Flo Lloyd-Hughes, speaking of bad smells, I don't mean you, Flo, but you. There's sewage pouring out of a manhole outside your house.
There is, unfortunately. And even though, you know, it's not even to do with our property, we're trying to be good citizens and reported it to Thames Water because no one else seems to want to. So any minute now, Thames Water might turn up to deal with the stink, we hope.
Excellent. Will it affect your performance on the pod, do you think? Or can you, I mean, how's the aroma in the house right now?
The aroma in the house is fine. It's only bad if you open the front door, but I'm far enough from the kind of, you know, zone, the hazard zone, that is actually okay. But it is going to be 30 degrees today, so who knows? Anything can happen.
Oh, 30 degrees is not what, it's not when you want a sewage problem.
It's not good sewage weather.
Ben Fisher, how's your sewage?
Yeah, I can't compete really, Max, with some of these tales of woe. Yeah, it's all good here, thanks.
Excellent news. Shall we start then with the Premier League? Brighton 1, Chelsea 3. Fun game this. I thought Barry, Chelsea were pretty lucky and Brighton were really impressive.
Yes, I would agree with that. I don't think it was anywhere near a brilliant performance by Chelsea, who are obviously under the microscope this season after spending all that money during the summer, presumably more money still to be spent. But they did enough. They won away from home in a game. They could have dropped points in. Some of their players didn't look quite on it. I think it's too early to say this new Lampard revolution is destined to fail, but he talked up some of the performers after the game who I think weren't great, they were okay.
Is there part of you that wants them to fail, Barry?
Yes, a huge part of me wants them to fail. I've gone all in on this being the season Frank Lampard gets found out, so if he doesn't, I'm going to look a bit of a chump.
It won't be the first time. Flo, you're nodding.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. I think he's kind of in way over his head. And the fact that the club have spent so much money this summer on someone who I don't think is going to be around for very long is a big risk, and brought in players that he wanted who are big star names for a lot of money. And to go this sort of deep into a project when the person who's leading the project doesn't really know what he wants or where he's going with it is just such a huge risk. And I understand that he's a big club name and someone that the fans love. But I definitely feel like some fans last season were questioning how good he could be in that role.
Do you think some people want Frank Lampard to fail because other people in the media are so behind him, whatever he does? I mean, I don't sort of feel strongly either way, I guess.
I don't necessarily want Lampard to fail, but I do agree, Max, that part of me would find it quite amusing because he does have so much support in the media. And I think if he wasn't Frank Lampard, he'd have got an awful lot more criticism last season for a team that shipped goals at an alarming rate. And on the evidence of what we saw last night, and I wouldn't read too much into it because a lot of the players clearly aren't match fit, but look to me like they could be set to concede a hell of a lot of goals again this season. Like they cannot defend set pieces properly. That's a big thing, and it's something they really need to sort out, and there's no evidence to suggest anything has been done to sort this out.
There was a lovely moment where Kai Havertz tried to play a crossfield pass and just booted it out of play, and I'm a huge fan of anyone at that level of football doing something that I would do on a football pitch. The battle of the right backs, Ben. I mean, Reece James's goal was absolutely brilliant, and he showed his versatility, went into midfield at the end. But Tarek Lamptey, who Chelsea sold to Bayern, is just phenomenal, isn't he?
Yeah, it looks a great pickup. I think they paid something like a maximum sort of $3 million for him. I think the initial fee was about half of that. Great little pickup for Brighton. Real menace, really. He really gets forward. And I suppose it's one of those where Chelsea are looking and thinking, why do we let this guy go? Obviously, they've got a wealth of players, many of whom are again out on loan. But and people like Conor Gallagher look like they're going to spend another season out on loan. But fair play to Lamptey for making a brave decision, because I'm pretty sure he could have just stayed put and challenged or sort of been in and around it. But yeah, it looks a great move for him and for Brighton.
And with that kit and that collar, and he looks so young, he just looks like a little schoolboy, doesn't he? Like, and whatever he does, like, he's so dynamic, and then he just sprints back into his position. I mean, England have a lot of good right backs, Barry. You could argue that, you know, people have talked about Trent Alexander-Arnold going into midfield because in some ways it feels like the dream for everyone to end up into said midfield, and why can't Trent Alexander-Arnold just be a brilliant right back? But if we have a problem in midfield, we have so much strength at right back that you could give that a try.
Well, England have a lot of very good players in almost every position. I don't really understand this clamour. Well, is it a clamour even? But for to move Trent Alexander into midfield, why not just let him be a really, really good right back?
Well, because we don't have a really brilliant centre mid who can pick the ball up on the half turn and play incisive passes. I don't know if Trent can do it, but we don't seem to have one who can. Maybe Foden, I guess.
The problem there, I suppose, is that Jurgen Klopp doesn't need to turn Trent Alexander into a midfielder, and if he doesn't do it, then it would be a bit risky for Gareth Southgate to try it with the limited time he has available with the squad. But I personally would just leave him be out on the right flank, unfettered.
A couple of listeners have given us an entire England team of right backs. Kyle Walker, obviously in goal because he's played in goal. Lorcan says he puts Kyle Walker-Peters at right back, which is, you know, quite bold. Wan-Bissaka, Trippier, centre backs, James Justin left back, with Alexander Arnold and Reece James behind Lamptey, Max Aarons, Ainsley Maitland-Niles, and Bogle up front. Esme says Kyle Walker, Wan-Bissaka, Smalling and Phil Jones, so I'm not having that because they're not right backs, are they? But has put Martin Kelly up front for a big man up front. Paul says, good conversation piece. Is right back the easiest position in football? Flo?
No, not at all. You have to be so, like, look at the fitness and endurance of someone like Trent Alexander-Arnold. You have to be, to play at fullback, you have to be so fit and also have a great delivery of the ball. So I think it's one of the hardest positions in football. Okay, I think it's easy just to be a big man up front and just stand there and wait for someone to ping the ball into you. I think fullback's so hard.
Do you think target man is perhaps the easiest position in football?
Yeah, definitely. But you barely have to do any work, and then you can just stand in the box and, like, you know, push a few people over and then get your chance. You could be fat and slow and have a really good career.
Grant Holt will be furious. Steve Howard's will be absolutely livid. Jeff Horsfield, I can just see them all. More people to hate Flo along with the whole of Leeds and Jack Grealish. Ben, any thoughts on the easiest position, Ben?
I'm not having up front. I think you get, you know, you have to take a fair bit of
I think only if you're a big target man is it easy up front. If you're someone who does do a lot of running, and if you're like a Raul Jimenez sort of person, then that is a tough position because he's much smarter than that and he works a lot harder than that. But if you're literally just going to stand like a kind of big Matt Smith at Millwall and just stand there and wait for the ball, that is easy.
I think that the lesser spotted number 10 has got to be one of the easiest roles. You know, just floating around, little dainty player, just popping it about nice and pretty. That's got to be one of the easiest.
I would go goalkeeper, although I suspect we're about to talk about a man who's making it look a very difficult job indeed in the Chelsea ranks.
Yeah, since he joined Chelsea in 2018, Kepa Arrizabalaga has conceded more Premier League goals from outside the box than any other goalkeeper. Was he at fault for this goal?
Yes. I mean, he should have kept it out. It was a soft one, a dipping shot with not a great deal of venom, and it kind of bounced under his arms, didn't it? And not the start he wanted. He's a player who's almost certainly very low in confidence. His manager said he was happy with him after the game. I suspect that is a lie.
Would you like, Barry, the sort of Jeff Shreve's role when Frank Lampard says, I'm really happy with my goalkeeper, to say, I think you're lying?
I probably wouldn't use that exact phrase, but I would question, like, what? Why are you happy with him? What has he done to make you happy? Because I've never seen any evidence that he's a £70 million goalkeeper. Like, David De Gea was excellent for Manchester. Started, had a ropey enough start at Manchester United. Then I think won their Player of the Season award 3 or 4 seasons in a row. Was outstanding. And last season had a poor season. But you could at least see why he was at one point considered the best goalkeeper in the world. I've never seen any indication from Kepa that he's a brilliant goalkeeper.
Producer Jack noting that Jamie Carragher on Sky last night was saying that Chelsea was sort of, that Bilbao pulled a fast one on Chelsea. And we're like, he's really good. Look at this golden house you can buy. And actually it wasn't. Peter says, did you hear the Brighton PA? I'm obsessed with PA, you know, public tannoy men still working the grounds when there's no fans there. Did you hear the Brighton PA inform players of when their next home game is? I really hope a few of them only found out about their Carabao Cup game when leaving the pitch. Thanks for all your attendance today. It was naught. Next home game will be next Tuesday night. I'm not sure what they're still doing there. To Bramall Lane, Sheffield United 0, Wolves 2. What a start for Wolves. 2 up after 6 minutes. Frustrating for those of us who were trying to watch it on the laptop and couldn't get it working until the 7th minute. But it was a great performance from Wolves, wasn't it, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the way they started was just amazing. It really sort of set the benchmark of how good that team can be. That was sort of peak Wolves, wasn't it? I just love Raul Jimenez. I'm not sure there's a better number nine in the division. I'm not saying, I think there's a few maybe on par with him, but I don't think there's many you would take over him. I just think he's mustard. He does everything inside the box, outside the box, holds up. There was one point last night where we chested the ball and it just sort of smacked off that bare chest of it, just brilliant. Great performance, and I think they could go really strong.
When you say bare chest, had he just suddenly gone full sort of macho and ripped his shirt off to chest the ball down? And
when I was picturing him, he's just so strong, is he? When he leaps up, I just think, yeah, it's almost got that strength just to reveal all, bare all and just go for it. I mean,
but he's also got that subtlety as well, Flo, has he? Because the finish was just perfection.
Yeah, he's just such a complete player. And I know a lot of the commentary yesterday was about how long Wolves can hold on to him for. And I know I've spoken on this podcast before about how kind of invested in the club and the city he is, and how him and his wife kind of really are a big part of that club and its culture. And I think that bodes well for how long they can hold on to him. But I think a lot of the conversation and narrative last night was about him wanting to probably eventually play Champions League football and having to make that progression. So it will be interesting whether this is potentially his last season with Wolves. And obviously, if there's an amazing offer that comes in, Wolves can't turn that down despite their amazing financial backing. You know, they need to make the most of those kind of offers. And they have done that a little bit this summer with some of the players that have moved on. But he's obviously a huge asset.
You just think how sad Matt Doherty looked on Sunday.
Was very sad. I was thinking that yesterday. I was like, oh, thinking watching the game, I bet he regrets that move. Because I know you guys already touched on the Sunday games, but it was just this stark contrast of how miserable everyone at Spurs looks. And I think he must maybe be really regretting his decision.
Never go back, eh? Barry, I got a text from my friend Martin saying, Barry is a genius, with a hashtag. I don't think it will trend, but you know, you began saying Wolves will get top four and they won their first game of the season. So you're right.
Yeah, I'm absolutely right. It's a bit early to say that. I mean, Raul Jimenez looks really happy at Wolves. It's an exciting project to be part of. I think if he's wants to play Champions League football, there's quite a good chance he could play it with Wolves next season. They really roared out of the trap. His goal was wonderful. Roman Saiss's header was also excellent. Leaning backwards, he still managed to guide it in, which is a very difficult skill to master. And as Chris Wilder said after the game, I think if it had started at 7 minutes past six, we'd probably been okay. But Wolves are a hugely impressive team, and I expect big things from them this season. My only concern is possible fatigue, but they didn't look fatigued last night. They looked fit, lively, sharp. And compared to, say, Chelsea, and I don't want to pick on Frank Lampard, but they just looked a completely different proposition.
Actually, I thought Sheffield United in the second half, Ben, you know, mounted a bit of a fight. They hit the post, didn't they? Perhaps with a better centre forward, they would look perhaps stronger. I thought they showed enough for Sheffield United fans not to panic about second season syndrome quite yet.
Yeah, it was very Chris Wilder, wasn't it? The second half, it was sort of very up and at them, and that was what they needed. They needed the response, and I think Wilder said, you know, they didn't get the white flag out, and they didn't. It was a fairly decent response. I think quite a few teams probably go under it at 2-0. You know, it could have been 3-0 in 20 minutes or something, but they didn't do that. Just on Jimenez as well, he's not infallible. He I don't know if you saw when he did an elaborate gender reveal of his child at Molineux, where him and his partner were smacking the ball into the net, and then it was like the sort of mini pyrotechnics almost behind the goal in the colour of whether it was a male or a female, or a boy or a girl, I should say. And they got it wrong. So I think a few weeks later, they had to do another one because they got it wrong. So he's not perfect.
And it took a while as well when they were doing that for him to even hit the target.
I think she had a couple of good little shots before he did. So
you can't blame Raul Jimenez on putting the wrong colour confetti in the pyrotechnics, can you? Because it's the idea that the parents don't know and they find out.
Well, you can blame him for having a gender reveal party in the first place.
That is true.
Yeah, exactly.
And at Molineux, seems strange.
Yeah.
That'll do for part one. Part two, we will talk about the Football League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Week. Let's talk about the Football League, which includes, obviously, the best league in the world, the Championship. First of all, the serious bit, and we have touched on this. Barry, you did a pod when I was away about the future of football, which was really good. But there are, you know, a lot of Football League clubs who are in trouble, financial trouble. Have you been surprised, Ben, that most clubs have survived COVID? I was really worried, and I kept repeating it when I was on the radio, saying, you know, we want the Football League to look like it does when we come out of this crisis, as it looked when it came in, you know, as a sort of at the very least. And I kind of was worried that more clubs would go to the wall in the last few months.
Yeah, I think clubs are, I mean, happy's maybe a touch too strong, but I think equally they're really obviously not jumping up and down, because the key months, I think, have always looked like being September and October, which, you know, which is right now. They're conscious that this is when it's really going to bite. There is this need for fans to come back, especially lower down the chain, in terms of, you know, just bringing in revenue, because simply streams don't cut it in terms of counteracting what they're losing out on. I know the EFL are lobbying the government sort of regularly, and this week especially, over the return of fans. They're desperate for that to happen. Obviously, some of those pilot events were, you know, the plug was pulled on them, and understandably so, but they are really important in terms of, you know, simply getting some money back into the coffers, as it were. And I think some of those clubs are in limbo. They don't really know where they're at. At what point down the line are they going to have some green shoots? It's very murky and unclear.
I don't really think many are through it yet. We're soon going to be entering the peak of redundancy season, which I think is going to be bleak for not just football clubs, but so many people in the industry. And I think we already saw it a little bit with Arsenal, and they obviously got a lot of criticism for that because of the pay cut that the players took. And I think a lot of clubs are going to be going through the same things. Some staff who've come back from furlough because the season started, but then sort of clubs working out what the long-term implications of this are going to be. And also, if there's a second wave, or if the fans can't come back in, then what's that going to look like for the rest of the year? And when people start reforecasting and things start to look quite bleak, I think it's going to be, you know, probably December, January, February, where we see a lot of the kind of long-term implications of this. And for clubs who are smart and have a kind of long history of turning over assets, like Brentford, who've managed to sell Ollie Watkins to Villa for £30 million, they probably won't be too worried. They've obviously got a new stadium that they want to fill, but there's a lot of other clubs who aren't savvy like that, or don't have, you know, big academies that they can produce that sort of talent. Obviously, I know Brentford system's a little bit different. So I think, yeah, I think we won't start to really see that until the next few months, where things could get a little bit bleak.
I know I like to spend a lot of this podcast analysing Barry's predictions, particularly the ones that don't work out. But Ben, you very kindly did predictions for the Championship, League One and League Two. I've gone through your title challenges and after week one made my verdict. So the Championship, you did okay, didn't you? You suggested Stoke, Norwich, Watford and Brentford will be the four to challenge for the title. Stoke drew, Norwich won at Huddersfield, Watford beat Middlesbrough, Brentford lost to Birmingham, 2 from 4. Explain your predictions, please, Ben.
Yeah, I think Brentford will be strong again. I think this initial period is tricky because of Ollie Watkins going. Ben Rahm, I think, will go as well, albeit for the right price. They want about $25 million for him. So I think the first few weeks could be a little bit shaky, a bit hairy for them. But I think once they get up and running, they could. And to be fair, they're always notoriously slow starters, Brentford, or they have been in recent years. So I think they'll look good. Much rest on Ivan Toney. Scored goals for fun in League One. Can he do it in the Championship? I don't think he had the most straightforward debut against Birmingham. Norwich look really good in terms of what they've got. They've just got so much ammunition, such a big squad. Again, they could look very different come the close of the transfer window next month. It'd be interesting what they look like. Lots of young, exciting players, though. You know, and I think they have a nice mix. Watford have this interesting blend where they've got a lot of players sort of over 30s and then a lot under 20s, not an awful lot in between. But that looks to be quite a nice cocktail for them at the moment. And Stoke, I just fancy, would do so much better under a full season of Michael O'Neill, who clearly knows what he's doing. And let's face it, they've got a great squad there as well. And they should have been challenging last season, really.
Obviously, the high point of the Watford-Middlesbrough game was the referee Keith Stroud picking the ball off the plinth and kissing it, therefore not being able to use it for breaking COVID regulations before the game had started. Flo, your hand is up. How polite.
I know. Well, I do. Yeah, I think it's really interesting with Stoke because they've kind of got this reputation as laughably like signing players on big wages who maybe once have been pretty big names in football and they're not really doing anything with it. But I think with Michael O'Neill, they might have finally sort of cracked it. And I know, Max, you were asking for interesting players who've playing in the Football League now. And I think John Obi Mikel is one of those people. Obviously, a lot of people would remember him from being at Chelsea for quite a long time. And he's now popped up at Stoke, signed in August. Obviously, I think he became a bit of a kind of got a funny reputation at Chelsea, I guess, because he wasn't necessarily that good, but he would always sort of be in and around the squad, but he wasn't exactly this like legendary player, but he's there. And also I actually really like the look of Bournemouth. I think they've gone for consistency by putting Tyndall in post, and they've managed to keep some good players. Obviously they've sold Ramsdale and Nathan Ake for big money, so that they've got a lot in the summer from that. But I think that they've still got talent, and they beat Rovers 3-2 on Saturday. And Arnold Danjuma, who they signed in 2019 for $13 million, finally looks like he might kind of prove why he was worth $13 million. So I'm kind of looking. I think Bournemouth could bounce back up. The only thing is that the right thing for them to do? And could they end up just being like a sort of yo-yo up and down team if they do that? And is it more important for them to kind of build a bit more of a foundation?
John Obi Mikel, 2 league titles, 3 FA Cups, a Champions League, Europa League with Chelsea, 11 years at the club. I'm contractually obliged to say, but can he do it on a cold Tuesday, etc.?
Well, exactly. That's the real question.
Barry, what's your hot take in the Championship this season? What are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to see how Wickham get on. Obviously, Marcus Bean, friend of the show, spent a long time there. So I always used to keep an eye out for them when he was playing, and still do, because I don't think you can overestimate or overstate what an incredible achievement it is for Gareth Ainsworth to have got them into the Championship. They lost against Rotherham at the weekend, who were also promoted, but played okay. And I was actually quite struck by, after the game, how complimentary, say, Paul Warren, the Rotherham manager, and Ainsworth were of each other and of each other's teams. And that I watched extended highlights of quite a few championship games yesterday, just ahead of this today, and just to try and get my eye in. And that seemed to be a recurring theme in the post-match interviews. It seems to be less sort of angry than the Premier League. I no doubt that will change as time goes by and managers come under increasing pressure, because it's a very unforgiving league to be in if you're not doing well. But and I would steer listeners to an excellent interview Donald McRae did with Gareth Ainsworth, I think it was last week. You'll find it on the website. Just a really fascinating guy who's doing a brilliant job. And I suspect they will struggle, but I really hope they stay up. How do you think they'll fare, Ben?
I think we can, you know, they won't go down without a fight. And I think that will be such a key element for them, that they're not blessed with the best team, the best squad. They don't pay transfer fees. They've done it begrudgingly almost this summer, because they have to. But I think they will get results at places where people won't expect them to. And to be fair, I think Rotherham might be better equipped than they have been on previous occasions as well. So it'll be interesting. It's a really wide open league. I know you can kind of make that argument every year, but it does feel that way. If you look at the fixtures, you know, last weekend or this weekend, there's no obvious standout team. Even the ones we talked about for being up there, I don't think they're far and away above anybody else, really.
I think in that interview with Donald McRae, I think Ainsworth said that the first player he actually spent money on since he got to the club, and how long has he been there? 5 years, more, was Daryl Murphy, who missed a sitter against Rotherham, a really awful howler to miss more or less an open goal. He did have to stretch a bit, but he should have scored. But yeah, it's just remarkable to have all these players that none of them came on for a fee.
Concur with both what Ben and Barry said. I mean, Gareth Ainsworth, one of the nicest men in football, which sounds like a cliche, but truly is. And you see how much his players love him. Such a great personality as well. Has his rock band on the side. QPR legend, and someone who I think will end up back at the club managing. A lot of people wanted him to take the spot after McLaren left, and I think the club made the right decision by not giving it to him. So I think it is a little bit early, and he also, with what he's got at Wickham, he plays a certain style of football, which obviously a lot of people have talked about how that reflects in the stats, but I don't think that was really the right thing for QPR at the time. But also, what Ben was saying about the league being really open this season is certainly true. I think in the last few years, we've had out and out better quality teams who play really high intensity football and have very good squads, like West Brom, like Leeds, who you always felt like, and Norwich when they went up, you always felt like these guys were the favourites. Whereas this season, it's really hard to pick one of those squads. I think there's lots of good teams, but there's no one who you out and out think, oh, these guys can do it. I also think Bristol City, who got brought in a lot of players in the summer, a new era without Lee Johnson, I think, you know, they could do something as well. They really need to get into the playoffs because fans are pretty fed up. Another player I also think a lot of people who listen to this podcast will be interested in seeing this season is Morgan Gibbs-White, who was so highly touted when Wolves came up and has kind of fallen off the radar a little bit. And he's now popped up on loan from Wolves at Swansea, and Rian Brewster did so well when he was on loan there last season. After the restart, I think he scored like 8 goals or something, managed to get Swansea into the playoffs. So I think Morgan Gibbs-White scoring is his first game on Saturday. So I think he's going to be a really exciting player to watch that I'm sure will pop up on a lot of people's radars as well.
League One, Ben, your title challengers: Peterborough lost to Accrington, Sunderland drew 1-1, obviously, with Bristol Rovers, Oxford lost 2-0 at Lincoln, and Portsmouth drew 0-0 with Shrewsbury, 0-4 there. Ben, well done.
Underwhelming start, hey? That was disastrous for Peterborough, really, especially because they got Sammy Smodix in after that preview went up. And, you know, in terms of the squad, I think it's difficult to top what they've got in the ranks, but I think they'll be up there. Obviously, they're so miffed at the way last season panned out that they have to be up there almost. Portsmouth as well, they've strengthened again. Michael Jacobs has come in, ex-Wigan player, nice little player in that league. He's been promoted out of that league before. Yeah, and Oxford as well, they've got Marcus McGuane, who is an interesting loan signing, actually from Forest, but spent some time at Barcelona. It was the last first Englishman to play for Barcelona since Gary Lineker, albeit only a handful of minutes in a cup match. But comes with plenty of pedigree, ex-Arsenal trainee. And yeah, I think that, you know, they had Ben Woodburn last year, which was an exciting pickup. Didn't quite happen, had problems with injuries. And this year they've got another one in McGuane from Forest.
Former Bury manager Ryan Lowe, obviously they were expelled from the EFL. He took over at Plymouth and took five ex-Bury players with him. It's a bit like that happens in amateur football. You know, suddenly a new team is just nicked from another one. And they just go, I'm sure you were Alexandra Palace last year. But anyway, they won their first game 1-0 at Blackpool. League Two. Ben, your title challenger is Salford. They drew with Exeter. Bolton lost to Forest Green. Mansfield drew 0-0. So 0-3 there, Ben.
Yeah, it's not going too well, is it, mate? Thanks for this.
It's a marathon, not a sprint.
Do you know what? To be honest, Ben, I went into it with an open mind, and this is just what happened.
Yeah, that's fine. I think Exeter are really interesting. You know, they've got another raft of academy graduates. I think five started at Salford, and that was a decent result for them, a point on the opening weekend. One of the most intriguing things I saw on the weekend was Tommy Smith, ex-Ipswich defender, did the hacker for his initiation at Colchester, which went down like an absolute treat in front of his teammates. Performed the hacker in must have been what the team hotel or a similar surround. And it got me thinking, you know, in terms of initiations, it's quite an interesting start to life at Colchester as well, you know.
I don't know. There's something about initiations that it feels a little bit too bantery for me. I mean,
you're not having that? I quite like that. The hacker.
Do you feel you should have had to do an initiation before your first pod appearance, Ben?
Yeah, I don't know what I would have done.
Is he from New Zealand? Otherwise, that just seems a bit random.
Yeah. He's New Zealand international. Yeah, maybe I should have pointed that out.
Because there's so many Tommy Smiths that have played in the Football League. I was thinking, the ones that I'm thinking of aren't Kiwi.
Would you watch a game show where every Tommy Smith who had ever played football had to do the hacker?
It was a lineup, and you had to work out which Tommy Smith was Tommy Smith.
Well, it's from New Zealand.
The hacker's better than, you know, the classic Neo, isn't it? You know, so sick or something. It's better than that.
Yeah, it's normally always karaoke.
Is So Sick a song by Neo? And could you just give me a bit of background on who Neo is? Just I'm saying, just for Barry's sake. I mean, unless Barry is fully aware of it.
I'll let Ben do that.
I mean, we're going back a few years, aren't we? It was an old school sort of classic. I must be going back at least 10 years.
Back 10 years, let me tell you, Ben, is not old school in my book.
Yeah.
My music knowledge stops abruptly at around 1999.
Mid 2000s R&B is what you want.
Okay, yeah. I stop at now 26, I reckon.
Well, I remember back in the glory days of Soccer AM, Max, when you...
Oh, don't even start.
On a weekly basis, had to interview some surly group of shoegazers who had no interest in being there and had probably been up late powdering their noses the previous night.
As I've said to you before, Barry, one of my biggest fears is being put in a room with all the indie bands I've ever interviewed and not being able to... It's like an escape room, but I'm not allowed to leave until I've put all the bands in their correct lineup. So, you know, the Klaxons are the Klaxons and the Editors are the Editors and the Cribs are the Cribs. And then I'm allowed to... It's like the Crystal Maze and suddenly it goes bing and I'm allowed out. To be fair to the hip-hop, you know, the hip-hop stars and the grime artists and the rappers, they were all much sort of more vocal because it was all about being cool and being being like a fast talker. Whereas the indie band, it was cool to say nothing. So you'd just go, oh, Dave, you're an Everton fan. He'd be like, not really. You'd be like, oh no, we got 10 minutes of this.
Yeah, it's not cool to like football in the indie world, really, is it?
So don't pretend. They pretend they're Swindon fans, and then you go, hey, what about Jan Arge Fjortoft then? And they go, who? You're like, ah. Oh.
Speaking of Swindon, actually, I think Swindon's an interesting one because they sold their best player, Owen Doyle, who is the Ginger Pele and has his own songs with the fans. He's gone on to Bolton, so he's dropped down the league after Swindon were promoted on PPG because his family are all sort of around Liverpool area. So it's really interesting that they've managed to get off to a good start despite not having the Ginger Pele in their squad this season.
Is he Irish?
He is.
I just thought James Collins was the Ginger Pele. Maybe there's more than one.
Talking of bands as well, because Swindon have the Smiths. They've got three players, Smith, Matt, Tyler and Johnny. And they all started in the victory of Rochdale, I think it was. I think Swindon could go well, actually. Them, Crewe and Plymouth, all the teams that got promoted out of League Two, all really have exciting managers. And be interesting what happens.
I almost got the mid-morning show at Radio Swindon. That would have been a different career turn, wouldn't it? Any final thoughts on the EFL before we move on, Ben?
In Grimsby, they've got a 15-year-old who scored last week and he made his league debut on the weekend, last weekend. And I just think that's amazing. You know, 15 in the first team fold. League 2 is meant to be this big, ugly, horrible, you know, get it in the mixer box type league. And a 15-year-old is off the bench and making a decent impression with Ian Holloway. So who must be quite a hard manager to impress, I imagine, to get up to those standards. So he must be doing something right. Louis Boyd is his name. So maybe one to look out for.
So Louis Boyd, and I will say for the tape, we've spent a long time trying to find Louis Boyd's birthday so we could tell you what was number one when he was born. But we can't find it. On the Grimsby Town website, it said he's born on the 1st of January, 1901. According to Grimsby Live, there's no record who Grimsby Town's youngest ever goal scorer is. So Boyd becomes the proud holder of that accolade at 15 years and 324 days old when he scored on Tuesday night. Oh, we can work out his birthday then. Producer Jack, could you go back 15 years and 324 days, please, while I read this out and find out who was number one? He's 144 days older than the holder of the youngest ever Football League goal scorer, who's had it for 92 years. That is Bristol Rovers striker Ronnie Dix, who made his debut for Rovers against Norwich City aged 15 years and 180 days back in 1928. Would you like to know the youngest ever professional footballer, everybody?
Go on.
Bolivian midfielder Mauricio Valdivieso holds the record for the youngest ever professional footballer, having made his debut for Aurora against La Paz in 2009 at the age of 12.
Wow, that's amazing.
A few days before his 13th birthday. So there you are. Producer Jack has worked it out. We think, and by all means, criticise us if we're wrong, that Louis Boyd was born on October the 27th, 2004. Number one was Eric, was it Call On Me by Eric Prydz? Is that right? Is that how I pronounce
it? Remember the music video?
When they're all in like Lycra, it's like a yoga class.
Yeah.
Were they washing cars in that video or is that a different one?
That might be another
Eric Prydz video. Right, I see. He's quite the modern man.
Yeah.
All right. So if he'd been born...
Wasn't that Carly Jepsen? The car washing video.
I'm not sure. Anyway, had he been born just a week earlier, it would have been Radio by Robbie Williams. Or just a tiny bit later, Ja Rule featuring R. Kelly and Ashanti with Wonderful. One of my truly favourite songs. Anyway, well done, Louis. That genuinely, Louis, if you're listening, took us about half an hour to find out all of that. Right, in part three, we'll begin by talking to Sid Lowe out in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk to Sid Lowe out in Spain as La Liga begins again. Hey, Sid.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. I've got a little bit of a headache. It's Tuesday morning. Apart from that, I'm all right.
Excellent news.
Before we get into the football chat, yeah. Sid, I want to know about this insect which terrorised you on, was it Sunday night, and kept you awake, mainly out of fear.
Yes, because I'm a massive coward. But this, I mean, it was a cricket, which makes me sound like even more of a coward to start like that. I'd much rather start with the suggestion that it was a dinosaur. And I turned off the light and then I heard this noise. It was really loud, really piercing and really clear. That was the other thing about it. Really kind of clear. And to the extent that I thought, this sounds like it's something electronic. And I promise you, I turned the light on and looked at my phone. I thought, is there some sort of alarm going off? And it wasn't my phone. So I kind of put my ear to the wall thinking maybe next door's got an alarm and it's going off. And it wasn't that. And the light was flickering a bit. So I thought maybe it was light. I started looking at the joints of the light to see if there was some sort of electrical thing not quite working. Looked at the telly, pulled the fridge out, looked behind the fridge. This is really weird. Got back into bed, turned the light off, and it started again. Oh, God. Turned the light back on, and it stops immediately. So I'm thinking, it must be to do with the light. There must be some loose connection in the light or something. Why would it make a noise like that? Anyway, I did this three or four times, and then I saw it. This evil kind of oil-coloured, thing kind of going with its mouth, and the eyes looked like Darth Vader's eyes, and it was fair to say I slightly bottled it. But I did put a cup over it, throw it out of a window. I was on the fifth floor, so I'm not sure if throwing it out of the window was entirely fair thing to do. Threw it out the window and then went to sleep covered by my sheets, because of course that will protect me if there really is a if there really is a dinosaur in the room.
Crickets can fly, can't they? Can crickets fly?
I don't know, and I'll be honest with you, Max, at that particular point, I wasn't particularly worried about whether or not they could fly. And I, you've never seen me shut a window so quick as well. I threw out the window, shut the window, I was like, ugh!
Anyway, that's all we've got time for. Thanks for coming
Good,
on.
Thanks.
Appreciate your
Pleasure.
Time.
Yep.
Tell us about Cadiz, beaten by Osasuna. They've got Alvaro Negredo leading the line.
Yeah, he was the only new player in the starting 11. Eight of the 11 had never even played in the first division before. But they're in a very weird position, Cadiz. Which is that they came up and obviously they've tried to do a lot of business in the summer, but they've basically not been able to. And they've got a huge squad. They've got 36 players, and yet they would like at least half of those to go. And of course, they've only got 3 weeks to do this now. The season's already started. They don't have any money. The market is pretty much stopped at the moment. Nothing's really happening. And so after 15 years to get back in the first division, they do look like they're going to have problems. Now, they shouldn't be quite as bad as they were at the weekend. The weekend they weren't quite as bad as certainly some of the local papers seem to think. But a couple of goals scored by Osasuna and Cadiz did look like a team that's still got a bit of a way to go if they're going to fight for any kind of survival in the first division, which would be a real pity because they're a universally popular club, very fun place, very fun group of fans, which obviously weren't in the stadium, which I thought was the most striking thing about the whole thing. And look, I know it's stating the bleeding obvious to tell everyone, oh, there was no one in the stadium and it was very sad and it feels very empty. But to be honest, there's a bit of me that thinks there's a moral imperative upon us to remind that every now and again, you know, because otherwise we just kind of get on with this and we treat it as normal. It's not normal and we shouldn't treat it as normal. And I think we shouldn't just kind of say, oh, well, it's just the way it is and get on with it. Because, you know, there's a little bit of me that thinks, and this might be pushing it a little bit, but you've waited 15 years to get back in the first division when you're a club that, like most clubs, but in Cadiz's case, perhaps even more so, is defined by its fans. You know, it's the fans that make them special, that make them different, that make them feel like something that's not the same as everybody else. There's no point in being in the first division if your fans can't go to the game. What are you there for? You know, you go up and the excitement is you go up and you play against bigger clubs and you're in the middle of bigger games and that your fans can really enjoy it. And then none of them there. I mean, to give you an example of that, there's one statue outside the ground and it's not dedicated to a player, a president or a manager. It's dedicated to the fans.
But Johnny Nicholson was very vocal about this in an article yesterday where he was saying that watching Premier League games with no fans at them is every game is like watching West Ham play at home in the London Stadium.
This obviously when this happened in Spain, lots of people said, well, Getafe have got a grand advantage now because they basically do this every week anyway. And obviously, look, it's true that you can still enjoy games. You can, I mean, I've enjoyed some of the games that I've been at. So it's not just a case of enjoying games watching on telly when you can kind of forget there's no fans. I've been at grounds when there's no fans and being able to enjoy them even without fans, even when you're in the middle of that really weird environment. And I think probably in Spain even more so because only six journalists go. It's not like in England, I think something like 25 go and there are more people within the ground. But it's still, of course, it's not the same. And I know everyone's going to say, well, yeah, we know that. But I think once in a while it's worth reminding ourselves of that.
Question from Pedestrian, who says, I'd like to hear about the shit show happening in Valencia, Sid.
Well, the amazing thing about the shit show in Valencia is they were the best of the teams in the first round of games by the end of it. They have lost, I think you can say, five starters. Ferran Torres, Rodrigo, of course, both went to England. Garay didn't sign a new contract. Parejo and Coquelin went to Villarreal for €8 million for the pair of them. They've essentially asset stripped. They've admitted that they're in financial trouble because of a combination of not getting into the Champions League and the COVID crisis. I suspect that if there was a big money offer for Maxi up front, they would probably sell him as well. And then before their first game of the weekend, Javi Gracia, who's their new manager, of course, you'll all remember him from Watford, who'd said nothing since his presentation, which was the best part of 6 or 7 weeks ago, had his pre-match press conference and very calmly had a rant. Very calmly said, look, we haven't bought people in. The squad is clearly debilitated. They haven't signed players that they told me they would sign. I've had promises broken. And then they go into the first game, which is a derby, although, you know, again, to labour the point a little bit, a derby when there's no fans in the ground doesn't feel like that much of a derby. A derby, and after 35 seconds, they're a goal down. And you think, here we go. This is, you know, this is going to be really just an incredible storm now. But they actually came back to 1-1. They went down again, another brilliant goal from Morales for Levante, and came back and won 4-2. And while defensively they're really, really bad, Diakabi and Mangala, the two centre-backs, one of whom will always play alongside Gabriel, look really, really weak still. Going forward, they're actually quite good, and the forward line is quite exciting, Kang In Lee and Maxi. And then on the right-hand side, they played an English kid, a 17-year-old, Yunus Musa, who I must confess I didn't know anything about, had been at Arsenal, had joined Valencia a couple of years ago, and he looked really, really good. I say an English kid, a few people have picked me up on this, particularly American people, born in New York, but an English kid, I think Ghanaian parents, and he looked really, really good indeed, and it was really quite exciting watching him play.
There was a nice Instagram post from owner Peter Lim's daughter, wasn't there? Which said, now deleted, but said, some Valencia fans are scolding and cursing at my family and I. Don't they get it? The club is ours and we can do anything we want with it. No one can say anything. That's a nice way to ingratiate yourself with the fans, isn't it?
Well, this is part of the issue here, which is that, in a way, what Kim Lim, and what great name that is, a rhyming name is always good. There was a kid at my school called Darren Farron whose sister was called Sharon. Well, this is Kim Lim. Anyway, sorry, Darren, if you're listening. Kim Lim put out this message. Or indeed Sharon, yeah. I don't think I ever met Sharon, though.
He wasn't by any chance of aristocracy. There's no way he could become a baron, is there?
That would be absolutely wonderful, wouldn't it? I don't think so. I mean, I might be wrong. Who knows? Perhaps he has blue blood. Anyway, so Kim Lim puts this statement out. Now, of course, on one level, this is true. And this is a fundamental issue with all clubs and their owners. Their owners can do what they want. But as you say, Max, one of the key things about this is that she said it. She was bold enough to actually say this. And I think Valencia fans have lots of problems with the ownership. I think most of them are well-founded. I think one or two of them possibly are overplayed. But I think the immense majority of them are oversounded. But one of them is precisely this, that the owners don't even for their own sake, don't seem to be paying any lip service to the fans. They don't even seem to be pretending that it's about them. There's been a kind of a willingness to be confrontational, which I've found baffling for a long time. That said, in fairness to them, there was a statement about 4 or 5 weeks ago when they... maybe a little bit less, actually, when they explained the current situation. They talked about how they had financial difficulties. They talked about how the alternative was bankruptcy and that was not good for anyone. And that was really rational. And there was a sense there of, I think, certainly in the tone, at least, of seeking reconciliation, which was, I think, a welcome sign. Because genuinely, apart from all the other things they've done wrong, I mean, the big thing, obviously, was last year, the sacking of Marcelino and the people working around him, like Pablo Longoria, who was the sporting director, and Matteo Alemán, who was the chief executive at the club. But it's the fact that they've kind of done it in a challenging way. So fans, Matt, and what are you going to do?
You wonder what photo you put with that Instagram post, just a selfie with like the peace sign. That's mad, isn't it? Anyway,
that's a good question. I can't remember if there was a photo. Now, I think the photo might have been the quote, if you see what I mean. I think she might have done it as a picture.
I see.
I honestly am not sure now.
Can you in 2 minutes answer the generic how's Messi getting on question and how's Gareth Bale and where's he going to be question?
Let's do it really fast. How is Messi getting on? Well, he's still captain, which I think was maybe a slight surprise, but it was voted for by the teammates. So perhaps it would have been too much of a statement to have taken it off him. He's one of four captains, as is always the case at Barcelona. He played his first game in a friendly against Segunda B, Nastic de Tarragona. He played behind the front, behind the forward in a line of three. They've moved from a 4-3-3 to 4-2-3-1. And he didn't smile very much. And that's how Messi is. Gareth Bale, the situation with Gareth Bale is what it's been for a long time. But I think there's more willingness to seek a solution now than perhaps there was before. The situation is that Real Madrid, I think, know that they're going to have to cover some of his wages to rescind his contract and get rid of him, rather than having got rid of him for free and saved all of his wages last year. Gareth Bale's position remains the same in that fundamentally, of course, he'd like to go, but it has to be on his terms. So let's see if there is a point at which Madrid say, OK, we will pay this much for you to go. Well, now, whether that's rescinding his contract and letting him walk away or doing some sort of loan agreement for him to go somewhere in which Madrid continue to pay a significant chunk of his, of course, very significant wages.
Sid, lovely to talk to you.
Pleasure. Cheerio.
Thank you, Sid. Sid Lowe out in Spain. Now, yesterday we talked about Neymar getting sent off and 5 red cards in that Marseille-PSG game. Partly my fault. I'd only seen the clip and hadn't seen the whole story, but... there is much more to it, and PSG say they will strongly support Neymar after he said he was racially abused by the Marseille defender Alvaro Gonzalez. Marseille have made a statement saying Gonzalez is not a racist. Neymar put out a long statement on his Instagram. Here's a bit of it. So, yesterday I revolted. I was punished with red because I wanted to hit someone who offended me. I thought I could not leave without doing something because I realized that those in charge would not do anything, did not notice or ignored the fact. I am black, son of black, grandson and great-grandson of black. Also, I am proud. I do not see myself as different from anyone. Yesterday, I wanted those in charge of the game, referees, assistants, to position themselves impartially and understand that there is no longer such a place for prejudiced attitude. The guy was a fool. I also acted like a fool for letting me get involved in that. You know what you said. I know what you did. More love to the world. Hashtag no racism. Hashtag say no to racism. We're going to do a Europod next Tuesday, so if there are any updates on that, we'll update on that. And we'll also talk about Jude Bellingham next week, who scored in his debut for Dortmund in the German Cup against Duisburg. Jadon Sancho also scoring a penalty. A question for Flo about the WSL. Dan says, for all the positivity around the WSL attracting superstar players, will it ultimately be to the detriment of the league as a whole if the top teams are winning 9-0 every other week? Chelsea beat Bristol City 9-0, Arsenal smashed West Ham 9-1.
Yeah, I think we've touched on it before on this, and I think I've said as well how the pandemic will definitely increase this gap in competition because the richer clubs who are backed by Premier League clubs are only going to get richer. We've seen that Chelsea and how much they've invested in the summer. And the smaller clubs, who Bristol City's, Birmingham's, the ones backed by Championship clubs, won't be investing as much. I think the interesting one about the weekend was Arsenal beating West Ham 9-1, and West Ham are actually a team that have invested a fair bit into their women's team. And I think that's maybe what is quite worrying, is even the clubs that are kind of trying aren't getting much reward for it, and the gap is still so huge. It's obviously exciting to see English teams doing so well. And even in the Champions League early stages in Europe, you do see really high aggregate scores, and the gap across Europe is still quite big. But the whole point of WSL going full-time, fully professional, is that you would create a strong league of, you know, 11, 12 teams we have this season who are all really competitive. But I think, you know, we do have this little mini league scenario. And in order to ensure that it doesn't get too out of control, then I think, you know, the FA maybe need to look at supporting the smaller teams. There is a bit of a salary cap already, but it's a soft cap. And I can't quite remember how it works. But yeah, I think the gap's only going to get bigger. And it's definitely one that they need to look out for, because it's not good seeing two 9-9 score lines in one weekend.
Mm. I mean, Alex Morgan is sort of the latest big name player to coming to Spurs on loan. Remind us of the other really high profile ones. Is this simply because the WSL is paying more than any other women's league? Is that why all these big stars are coming?
Not really. I think with America, it's more down to the pandemic. And obviously, America seemed to be the one country that's done as bad as the UK in terms of managing it. And so the way that it's worked out there, because we've got the Olympics coming up and so many players want to be playing competitive football, that's the biggest draw. There have been US players come over before, but not in such a big influx at one time. It's sort of been like pockets of people. And also a change of coach. The previous US coach, Jill Ellis, wasn't too pleased with players going abroad. And the new coach, Vlatko, has realised that actually at this time with the pandemic, it's really important that the players do go abroad, because they're going to be in better shape when the Olympics come around, and the US are always favourite for the Olympics like they are for the World Cup. So that's the main reason. Alex Morgan is only going to be here until end of December, so it's a very short one for her. She's coming back off having given birth, so it's a bit of a kind of like warm-up for her, where the other ones who are going to be staying for a full season is very much to kind of play very good high standard quality football, because in America they're playing basically glorified regional sets of friendlies because the pandemic is still pretty out of control. They can't be, obviously, because the country's so huge, they can't be flying around going from place to place in a safe way. So they've sort of done it in pockets. So it just wasn't going to work out if you want to play a good amount of games to stay there. So that's the main reason why we're seeing so many. But in the long run, post-pandemic, whenever that might be, we might see long-term additions from the US if their coach is still happy with them to come and play abroad.
Barry, Daniel Blazer has been in touch with us. He is the Crystal Palace programme editor. Okay. You remember yesterday we discussed Damien Delaney's dream dinner party guests of Chairman Mao, Napoleon Bonaparte, Joseph Stalin, Genghis Khan and Keith Richards. Daniel says, Damien Delaney and I would like to invite you to dinner, Max. Drop me a DM if you can. It'd be great to find out who is joining you and Ian Culverhouse at the dinner table for the next Crystal Palace programme. Barry, would you be interested in joining me for dinner with Damien Delaney?
Well, I don't seem to have been invited, so...
I'm sure I'm allowed to bring a plus one, and I can guarantee you one thing, Mrs. Rushton would not be interested in that dinner.
Well, okay, I'll tag along then. I love a free meal.
Wonderful. Finally, did everybody see, and are we allowed to find the name of Den Bosch's goalscorer last night slightly amusing? Den Bosch's Twitter just goes, 15, goal, Jiz Hornkamp. Congratulations to you, Jiz. And that'll do for today.
Oh, God.
Have I finally brought... Would Jimbo have done... He would have done, wouldn't he? Come on, Barry. Have I finally brought...
I like the way Flo and Ben managed diplomatically not... snigger in a schoolboy, schoolgirl fashion.
Oh, they're both laughing. They just laugh slightly less like Muttley than you, I would say.
I just leant far away from the microphone.
Anyway, that'll do. What a lovely place to end. Thank you for your time, Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you, Flo.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.